The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, we'll focus on Kurt Vonnegut, American author, born in 1922, died in 2007, who published 14 novels, 3 short story collections, 5 plays, and 5 nonfiction works over a career spanning 50 years. The most consistent theme in all of Vonnegut's works is the importance of basic human decency in a world of madness, chaos, and pain. He's best known for his landmark novel Slaughterhouse-Five, published in 1969, which is ranked as number 18 on the Modern Library's list of the top 100 novels of the 20th century. Vonnegut has been described as a rare imaginer by John Updike and by Jay McInerney, a satirist with a heart, a moralist with a whoopee cushion, a cynic who wants to believe. His fiercest social criticism is usually described in parable. I'll begin today with a short story originally published in 1962 in the science fiction magazine Worlds of If, in which Vonnegut creates a fictional world of the future where life and death are no longer matters of individual choice or destiny. And now, written as the number 2, the letter B, the letter R, the number 0, the number 2, and the letter B, To Be or Not to Be, by Kurt Vonnegut, Jr. Everything was perfectly swell. There were no prisons, no slums, no insane asylums, no cripples, no poverty, no wars. All diseases were conquered. So was old age. Death, barring accidents, was an adventure for volunteers. The population of the United States was stabilized at 40 million souls. One bright morning, in the Chicago Lying-In Hospital, a man named Edward K. Whaling, Jr., waited for his wife to give birth. He was the only man waiting. Not many people were born a day anymore. Whaling was 56, a mere stripling in a population whose average age was 129. X-rays had revealed that his wife was going to have triplets. The children would be his first. Young Whaling was hunched in his chair, his head in his hand. He was so rumpled, so still and colorless as to be virtually invisible. His camouflage was perfect. Since the waiting room had a disorderly and demoralized air, too. Chairs and ashtrays had been moved away from the walls. The little floor was paved with spattered drop cloths. The room was being redecorated. It was being redecorated as a memorial to a man who had volunteered to die. A sardonic old man, about 200 years old, sat on a stepladder, painting a mural he did not like. Back in the days when people aged visibly, his age would have been guessed at 35 or so. Aging had touched him that much before the cure for aging was found. The mural he was working on depicted a very neat garden. Men and women in white, doctors and nurses, turned the soil, planted seedlings, sprayed bugs, spread fertilizer. Men and women in purple uniforms pulled up weeds, cut down plants that were old and sickly, raked leaves, carried refuse to trash burners. Never, 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 not even in medieval Holland nor old Japan, had a garden been more formal, been better tended. Every plant had all the loam, light, water, air, and nourishment it could use. A hospital orderly came down the corridor, singing under his breath a popular song. If you don't like my kisses, honey, here's what I'll do. I'll go see a girl in purple, kiss this sad world toodaloo. If you don't want my loving, why should I take up all this space? I'll get off this old planet, let some sweet baby have my place. The orderly looked in at the mural, and the muralist, "Looks so real," he said. "I can practically imagine I'm standing in the middle of it." "Well, what makes you think you're not in it?" said the painter. He gave a satiric smile. "It's called the Happy Garden of Life, you know." "Well, that's good of Dr. Hitz," said the orderly. He was referring to one of the male figures in white, whose head was a portrait of Dr. Benjamin Hitz, the hospital's chief obstetrician. Hitz was a blindingly handsome man. "A lot of faces still to fill in," said the orderly. He meant that the faces of many of the figures in the mural were still blank. All blanks were to be filled with portraits of important people on either the hospital staff or from the Chicago office of the Federal Bureau of Termination. "Must be nice to be able to make pictures that look like something," said the orderly. The painter's face curdled with scorn. "You think I'm proud of this daub?" he said. "You think this is my idea of what life really looks like?"
Well, what's your idea of what life looks like?" said the orderly.
The painter gestured at a foul drop cloth. "There's a good picture of it," he said. "Frame that, and you'll have a picture a damn sight more honest than this one."
"You're a gloomy old duck, aren't you?" said the orderly.
"Is that a crime?" said the painter.
The orderly shrugged. "If you don't like it here, Grandpa," he said, and he finished the thought with the trick telephone number that people who didn't want to live anymore were supposed to call.
The zero in the telephone number he pronounced not. The number was 2BR NOT 2B. It was the telephone number of an institution whose fanciful sobriquets included Automat, Birdland, Cannery, Catbox, Delouser, Easy Go, Goodbye Mother, Happy Hooligan, Kiss Me Quick, Lucky Pierre, Sheep Dip, Wearing Blender, Weep No More, and Why Worry? To Be or Not to Be was the telephone number of the municipal gas chambers of the Federal Bureau of Termination. The painter thumbed his nose at the orderly.
"When I decide it's time to go," he said, "it won't be at the Sheep Dip." "A do-it-yourselfer, eh?" said the orderly. "Messy business, Grandpa. Why don't you have a little consideration for the people who have to clean up after you?"
The painter expressed with an obscenity his lack of concern for the tribulations of his survivors.
"The world could do with a good deal more mess, if you ask me," he said.
The orderly laughed and moved on. Wailing, the waiting father mumbled something without raising his head, and then he fell silent again. A coarse, formidable woman strode into the waiting room on spike heels. Her shoes, stockings, trench coat, bag, and overseas cap were all purple, the purple the painter called the color of grapes on Judgment Day. The medallion on her purple musette bag was the seal of the service division of the Federal Bureau of Termination, an eagle perched on a turnstile. The woman had a lot of facial hair, an unmistakable mustache, in fact. A curious thing about gas chamber hostesses was that no matter how lovely and feminine they were when recruited, they all sprouted mustaches within 5 years or so.
Is this where I'm supposed to come?" she said to the painter.
"A lot would depend on what your business is," he said. "You aren't about to have a baby, are you?"
"They told me I was supposed to pose for some picture," she said. "My name's Leora Duncan." She waited.
"And you dunk people?" he said.
"What?" she said.
"Skip it," he said.
"Well, that sure is a beautiful picture," she said. "Looks like heaven or something."
"Or something," said the painter.
He took a list of names from his smock pocket. "Duncan, Duncan, Duncan," he said, scanning the list. "Yes, here you are. You're entitled to be immortalized. See any faceless body here you'd like me to stick your head on? We've got a few choice ones left." She studied the mural bleakly.
"Gee," she said. "They're all the same to me. I don't know anything about art."
A body's a body, eh? He said, all righty, as a master of fine art, I recommend this body here. He indicated a faceless figure of a woman who was carrying dried stalks to a trash burner.
Well, said Leora Duncan, that's more the disposal people, isn't it? I mean, I'm in service. I don't do any disposing.
The painter clapped his hands in mock delight. You say you don't know anything about art, and then you prove in the next breath that you know more about it than I do. Of course, the sheave carrier is wrong for a hostess. A snipper, a pruner, that's more your line. He pointed to a figure in purple who was sawing a dead branch from an apple tree. How about her, he said. You like her at all?
Gosh, she said, and she blushed and became humble. That puts me right next to Dr. Hitz.
That upsets you, he said.
Good gravy, no, she said. It's just such an honor.
Ah, you admire him, hey? He said.
Well, who doesn't admire him? She said, worshipping the portrait of Hitz.
It was the portrait of a tanned, white-haired, omnipotent Zeus, 240 years old.
Who doesn't admire him? She said again. He was responsible for setting up the very first gas chamber in Chicago.
Nothing would please me more, said the painter, than to put you next to him for all time. Sawing off a limb, that strikes you as appropriate?
Well, that's kind of like what I do, she said.
She was demure about what she did. What she did was make people comfortable while she killed them. And while Leora Duncan was posing for her portrait, into the waiting room bounded Dr. Hitz himself. He was 7 feet tall, and he boomed with importance, accomplishments, and the joy of living.
Well, Miss Duncan, Miss Duncan, he said, and he made a joke. What are you doing here? He said. This isn't where the people leave. This is where they come in.
Well, we're going to be in the same picture together, she said shyly.
Good, said Dr. Hitz heartily. And say, isn't that some picture?
I sure am honored to be in it with you, she said.
Well, let me tell you, he said, I'm honored to be in it with you. Without women like you, this wonderful world we've got wouldn't be possible.
He saluted her and moved toward the door that led to the delivery rooms.
Guess what was just born, he said.
I can't, she said.
Triplets, he said.
Triplets! She said. She was exclaiming over the legal implications of triplets.
The law said that no newborn child could survive unless the parents of the child could find someone who would volunteer to die. Triplets, if they were all to live, called for 3 volunteers.
Do the parents have 3 volunteers? Said Leora Duncan.
Last I heard, said Dr. Hitz, they had 1 and were trying to scrape another 2 up.
I don't think they made it, she said. Nobody made 3 appointments with us. Nothing but singles going through today, and unless somebody called in after I left. What's the name?
Wayling, said the waiting father, sitting up, red-eyed and frowsy. Edward K. Wayling, Jr. is the name of the happy father-to-be. He raised his right hand, looked at a spot on the wall, gave a hoarsely wretched chuckle. Present, he said.
Oh, Mr. Wayling, said Dr. Hitz, I didn't see you.
The invisible man, said Wayling. They just phoned me that your triplets have been born, said Dr. Hitz. They're all fine, and so is the mother. I'm on my way in to see them now.
Hooray, said Wayling emptily.
You don't sound very happy, said Dr. Hitz.
What man in my shoes wouldn't be happy, said Wayling.
He gestured with his hands to symbolize carefree simplicity. All I have to do is pick out which one of the triplets is going to live, and then deliver my maternal grandfather to the happy hooligan and come back here with a receipt.
Dr. Hitz became rather severe with Wayling, towered over him.
"You don't believe in population control, Mr. Whaling?" he said.
"I think it's perfectly keen," said Whaling tautly.
"Would you like to go back to the good old days, when the population of the Earth was 20 billion, about to become 40 billion, and then 80 billion, and then 160 billion? "Do you know what a druplet is, Mr. Whaling?" said Hitz.
"Nope," said Whaling sulkily.
"A druplet, Mr. Whaling, is one of the little knobs, one of the little pulpy grains of a blackberry," said Dr. Hitz. "Without population control, human beings would now be packed on this surface of this old planet like druplets on a blackberry. Think of it!" Whaling continued to stare at the same spot on the wall. "In the year 2000, said Dr. Hitz, "before scientists stepped in and laid down the law, there wasn't even enough drinking water to go around and nothing to eat but seaweed. And still, people insisted on their right to reproduce like jackrabbits, and their right, if possible, to live forever."
"I want those kids," said Whaling quietly. "I want all three of them."
"Of course you do," said Dr. Hitz. "That's only human."
"I don't want my grandfather to die either," said Whaling.
"Well, nobody's really happy about taking a close relative to the cat box," said Dr. Hitz gently, sympathetically.
"I wish people wouldn't call it that," said Leora Duncan.
"What?" said Dr. Hitz.
"I wish people wouldn't call it the cat box and things like that," she said. "It gives people the wrong impression."
"You're absolutely right," said Dr. Hitz. "Forgive me."
He corrected himself, gave the municipal gas chambers their official title, a title no one ever used in conversation.
"I should have said ethical suicide studios," he said.
"That sounds so much better," said Leora Duncan.
"This child of yours, whichever one you decide to keep, Mr. Whaling," said Dr. Hitz, "he or she is going to live on a happy, roomy, clean, rich planet, thanks to population control, in a garden like that mural there." He shook his head. "Two centuries ago, when I was a young man, it was a hell that nobody thought could last another 20 years. And now, centuries of peace and plenty stretch before us as far as the imagination cares to travel." And he smiled luminously. The smile faded as he saw that Whaling had just drawn a revolver. Whaling shot Dr. Hitz dead. "There's room for one, a great big one," he said. And then he shot Leora Duncan. "It's only death," he said to her as she fell. "There, room for two." And then he shot himself, making room for all three of his children. Nobody came running. Nobody seemingly heard the shots. The painter sat on the top of his stepladder, looking down reflectively on the sorry scene. The painter pondered the mournful puzzle of life demanding to be born, and once born, demanding to be fruitful, to multiply and to live as long as possible. To do all that on a very small planet that would have to last forever. All the answers that the painter could think of were grim. Even grimmer, surely, than a cat box, a happy hooligan, an easy go. He thought of war. He thought of plague. He thought of starvation. He knew that he would never paint again. He let his paintbrush fall to the drop cloths below, and then he decided he had had about enough of life in the happy garden of life, too, and he came slowly down from the ladder. He took Whaling's pistol, really intending to shoot himself, but he didn't have the nerve. And then he saw the telephone booth in the corner of the room. He went to it, dialed the well-remembered number, 2B R not 2B.
"Federal Bureau of Termination," said the very warm voice of a hostess.
"How soon could I get an appointment?" he asked, speaking very carefully.
Well, we could probably fit you in late this afternoon, sir, she said. It might even be earlier if we can get a cancellation.
All right, said the painter. Fit me in, if you please. And he gave her his name, spelling it out.
Thank you, sir, said the hostess. Your city thanks you. Your country thanks you. Your planet thanks you. But the deepest thanks of all is from future generations.
And now, from the page-turner section of the June 13, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, What Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five Tells Us Now, by Salman Rushdie. I first read Slaughterhouse-Five in 1972, 3 years after it was published, and 3 years before I published my own first novel. I was 25 years old. 1972 was the year of inching slowly toward the Paris Peace Accords, which were supposed to end the war in Vietnam. Though the final ignominious American withdrawal, the helicopters airlifting people from the roof of the American Embassy in Saigon, would not take place until 3 years later, at which point, by way of a small footnote to history, I had become a published writer. I mention Vietnam because, although Slaughterhouse-Five is a book about the Second World War, Vietnam is also a presence in its pages, and people's feelings about Vietnam have a good deal to do with the novel's huge success. 8 years earlier, in 1961, Joseph Heller had published Catch-22, and President John F. Kennedy began the escalation of the United States' involvement in the conflict in Vietnam. Catch-22, like Slaughterhouse-Five, was a novel about the Second World War that caught the imagination of readers who were thinking a lot about another war. In those days, I was living in Britain, which did not send soldiers to fight in Indochina, but whose government did support the American war effort. And so, when I was at university and afterward, I, too, was involved with thinking about and protesting against the war. I did not read Catch-22 in 1961 because I was only 14 years old. As a matter of fact, I read both Slaughterhouse-Five and Catch-22 in the same year, a decade later, and the two books together had a great effect on my young mind. It hadn't occurred to me until I read them that anti-war novels could be funny as well as serious. Catch-22 is crazy funny, slapstick funny. It sees war as insane and the desire to escape combat as the only sane position. Its tone of voice is deadpan farce. Slaughterhouse-Five is different. There is much comedy in it, as there was in everything Kurt Vonnegut wrote, but it does not see war as farcical. It sees war as a tragedy so great that perhaps only the mask of comedy allows one to look it in the eye. Vonnegut is a sad-faced comedian. If Heller was Charlie Chaplin, then Vonnegut was Buster Keaton. His predominant tone of voice is melancholy, the tone of voice of a man who has been present for a great horror and lived to tell the tale. The two books do, however, have this in common. They are both portraits of a world that has lost its mind, in which children are sent out to do men's work and die. As a prisoner of war, aged 22, which is to say 3 years younger than I was when I read this story, Vonnegut was in the famously beautiful city of Dresden, locked up with other Americans in Schlachthof 5, where pigs had been slaughtered before the war, and was therefore an accidental witness to one of the greatest slaughters of human beings in history, the firebombing of Dresden in February of 1945, which flattened the whole city and killed almost everyone in it. So it goes. I had not remembered, until I reread Slaughterhouse-Five, that that famous phrase, so it goes, is used only and always as a comment on death. Sometimes a phrase from a novel or a play or a film can catch the imagination so powerfully, even when misquoted, that it lifts off from the page and acquires an independent life of its own. Come up and see me sometime and play it again, Sam, or misquotations of this type. Something of this sort has also happened to the phrase, so it goes. The trouble is that when this kind of liftoff happens to a phrase, its original context is lost. I suspect that many people who have not read Vonnegut are familiar with the phrase, but they, and also, I suspect, many people who have read Vonnegut think of it as a kind of resigned commentary on life. Life rarely turns out in the way the living hope for, and So It Goes has become one of the ways in which we verbally shrug our shoulders and accept what life gives us. But that is not its purpose in Slaughterhouse-Five. So It Goes is not a way of accepting life, but rather of facing death. It occurs in the text almost every single time someone dies, and only when death is evoked. It is also deeply ironic. Beneath the apparent resignation is a sadness for which there are no words. This is the manner of the entire novel, and it has led to the novel being, in many cases, misunderstood. I am not suggesting that Slaughterhouse-Five has been poorly treated. Its reception was largely positive. It has sold an enormous number of copies. The Modern Library ranked it 18th on its list of the 100 best English language novels of the 20th century, and it is also on a similar list issued by Time magazine. However, there are those who have accused it of the sin of quietism, of a resigned acceptance, even, according to Anthony Burgess, an evasion of the worst things in the world. One of the reasons for this is the phrase, so it goes. And it is clear to me from these critiques that the British novelist Julian Barnes was right when he wrote in his book, A History of the World in 10.5 Chapters, that irony may be defined as what people miss. Kurt Vonnegut is a deeply ironic writer who has sometimes been read as if he were not. The misreading goes beyond So It Goes, and has a good deal to do with the inhabitants of the planet of Trafalmador. As it happens, I am a great fan of Trafalmadorians, who look like toilet plungers, beginning with their mechanical emissary Salo, who, in an earlier Vonnegut novel, The Sirens of Titan, was marooned on Titan, a moon of the planet Saturn, needing a replacement part for his spaceship. And now comes the classic Vonnegut subject of free will, expressed as a comic science fiction device. We learn in The Sirens of Titan that human history has been manipulated by Trafalmadorians to persuade the human race to build large messages to Salo and to get our primitive ancestors to develop a civilization capable of doing so. Stonehenge and the Great Wall of China were some of the messages from Trafalmador. Stonehenge read, "Replacement part being rushed with all possible speed." The Great Wall of China said, "Be patient, we haven't forgotten about you." The Kremlin meant, "You will be on your way before you know it." And the Palace of the League of Nations in Geneva meant, "Pack up your things and be ready to leave on short notice." Trafalmadorians, we learn in Slaughterhouse-Five, perceive time differently. They see that the past, present, and future all exist simultaneously and forever and are simply there, fixed, eternally. When the main character of the novel, Billy Pilgrim, who is kidnapped and taken to Trafalmador, comes unstuck in time and begins to experience chronology the way Trafalmadorians do, he understands why his captors find comical the notion of free will. It seems obvious, at least to this reader, that there is a mischievous, ironic intelligence at work here. That there is no reason for us to assume that the rejection of free will by aliens, resembling toilet plungers, is a rejection also made by their creator. It is perfectly possible, perhaps even sensible, to read Billy Pilgrim's entire Trafalmadorian experience as a fantastic, traumatic disorder brought about by his wartime experiences as, quote, not real, end quote. Vonnegut leaves that question open, as a good writer should. That openness is the space in which the reader is allowed to make up his or her own mind. To read Vonnegut is to know that he was repeatedly drawn to the investigation of free will, of what it might be and how it might or might not function, and that he came at the subject from many different angles. Many of his ruminations were presented in the form of works by his fictional alter ego, Kilgore Trout. I love Kilgore Trout as deeply as I love the inhabitants of the planet Trafalmador. I even own a copy of the novel Venus on the Half Shell, in which the writer Philip Jose Farmer took a trout story written by Vonnegut and expanded it to novel length. Venus on the Half Shell is about the accidental destruction of the Earth by incompetent universal bureaucrats, and the attempt by the sole surviving human being to seek answers to the so-called ultimate question. In this way, Kilgore Trout inspired Douglas Adams' celebrated book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, in which, you may recall, the Earth was demolished by Vogons to make room for interstellar bypass, and the sole surviving man, Arthur Dent, went in search of answers. Finally, the supercomputer Deep Thought revealed that the answer to life, the universe, and everything was, and is, 42. The problem remains, what is the question? In Vonnegut's novel Breakfast of Champions, we learn about another Kilgore Trout story, Now It Can Be Told, written in the form of a letter from the creator of the universe addressed to the reader of the story. The creator explains that the whole of life itself has been a long experiment. The nature of the experiment was this: to introduce into an otherwise wholly deterministic universe one single person who is granted free will, to see what use he makes of it, in a reality in which every other living thing was, is, and always will be a programmed machine. Everyone in the whole of history has been a robot, and the single individual with free wills, mother and father, and everyone he knows, are also robots, and so, by the way, is Sammy Davis Jr. The individual with free will, God explains, is you, the reader of the story, and so God would like to offer you an apology for any discomfort you have endured. The end. It's worth adding one further detail. Throughout the many works by Kurt Vonnegut in which Kilgore Trout appears, he is consistently described as the worst writer in the world, whose books are utter failures, and who is completely and even contemptuously ignored. We are asked to see him simultaneously as a genius and a fool. This is not accidental. His creator, Kurt Vonnegut, was at once the most intellectual of playful fantasists and the most playfully fantastic of intellectuals. He had a horror of people who took things too seriously and was simultaneously obsessed with the consideration of the most serious things, things both philosophical, like free will, and lethal, like the firebombing of Dresden. This is the paradox out of which his dark ironies grow. Nobody who futzed around so often and in so many ways with the idea of free will, or who cared so profoundly about the dead, could be described as a fatalist, or a quietist, or resigned. His books argue about ideas of freedom and mourn the dead from their first pages to their last. Around the same time that I first read Slaughterhouse-Five and Catch-22, I also read another novel about a similar subject. That novel was War and Peace, which is longer than Heller's book and Vonnegut's book combined and isn't funny at all. On that first reading of Tolstoy's masterpiece, my 25-year-old self thought, in summary, loved peace, hated war. I was absorbed by the stories of Natasha Rostov, Prince Andrei, and Pierre Boucicault, and found the extremely long descriptions of fighting, especially of the Battle of Borodino, pretty boring, to be frank. When I reread War and Peace, perhaps 30 years later, I discovered that I felt exactly the opposite. The description of men at war, I thought, had never been bettered, and the greatness of the novel was to be found in those descriptions and not in the somewhat more conventional stories of the leading character. Loved war, hated peace. Rereading Slaughterhouse-Five, I also found my valuation of the text changing. The younger self was strongly drawn to fantasy and science fiction and sought out magazines called things like Galaxy and Astounding and Amazing. That young man, faced with Vonnegut's masterpiece, responded most strongly to the sci-fi aspects of the book. To read it again has been to discover the humane beauty of the non-sci-fi parts, which make up most of the book. The truth is that Slaughterhouse-Five is a great realist novel. Its first sentence is, "All this happened, more or less." In that non-fictional first chapter, Vonnegut tells us how hard the book was to write, how hard it was for him to deal with war. He tells us that his characters were real people, though he has changed all the names. One guy I knew really was shot in Dresden for taking a teapot that wasn't his. Another guy I knew really did threaten to have his personal enemies killed by hired gunmen after the war. And later, when his characters, the ones with the changed names, arrive at Schlachthof 5, Slaughterhouse 5, whose name he has not changed, he reminds us that he's there with them, suffering right along with them. Billy looked inside the latrine. The wailing was coming from in there. An American near Billy wailed that he had excreted everything but his brains. Moment later, he said, "There they go. There they go." He meant his brains. That was I. That was me. That was the author of this book. At one point, Vonnegut quotes a conversation he had with a filmmaker called Harrison Starr, who would achieve a kind of modest renown as the executive producer of Michelangelo Antonioni's movie about American hippies, Zabriskie Point, which was a huge commercial flop. Harrison Starr raised his eyebrows and inquired, "Is it an anti-war book?" "Yes," I said, "I guess." "You know what I say to people when I hear they're writing anti-war books?" "No." "What do you say, Harrison Starr?" "I say, why don't you write an anti-glacier book instead?" What he meant, of course, was that there would always be wars, that they were as easy to stop as glaciers. I believe that, too. Vonnegut's novel is about the inevitability of human violence and about what it does to the not particularly violent human beings who get caught up in it. He knows that most human beings are not particularly violent or not more violent than children are. Give a child a machine gun and he may well use it. Which does not mean that children are particularly violent. The Second World War, as Vonnegut reminds us, was a children's crusade. Billy Pilgrim is an adult to whom Vonnegut gives the innocence of a child. He is not particularly violent. He does nothing awful in the war or in his pre-war or post-war life or in his life on the planet Trafalmador. He seems deranged and is mostly thought of as crazy or as a near simpleton. But he has a characteristic in common with many of the characters Vonnegut wrote throughout his career, and it is this characteristic that allows us to care for him and therefore to feel the horror that he feels. Billy Pilgrim is lovable. If he were not lovable, the book would be unbearable. One of the great questions that faces all writers who have to deal with atrocity is it possible to do it? Are there things so powerful, so dreadful, that they are beyond the power of literature to describe? Every writer who faced the challenge of writing about the Second World War, and the Vietnam War, in fact, has had to think about that question. All of them decided they needed to come at the atrocity at an angle, so to speak, not to face it head on, because to do that would be unbearable. Günter Grass, in The Tin Drum, used surrealism as his angle of entry. His character, Oskar Matzerath, who stops growing because he can't face the adult reality of his time, is one kind of fabulous being that allows the author to enter the horror. A little Oscar with his tin drum, drumming the beats of history, is, like Billy Pilgrim, who has come unstuck in time, lovable. He is also, as the first sentence of The Tin Drum tells us, an inmate in a lunatic asylum. From opposite sides, German and American, these two deranged child men give us our finest portraits of the great derangement of their time. Vonnegut, like Grass, combines the surrealism that has become the reality of his character's time with a detached,
almost stunned tenderness that makes the reader feel fondly toward them, even as they stumble incompetently through life. It may be impossible to stop wars, just as it's impossible to stop glaciers, but it's still worth finding the form and the language that reminds us what they are and calls them by their true names. That is what realism is. Slaughterhouse-Five is also a novel humane enough to allow at the end of the horror that is its subject for the possibility of hope. Its final passage describes the end of the war and the liberation of the prisoners, who include Billy Pilgrim and Vonnegut himself. And somewhere in there it was springtime, Vonnegut writes, and in the last moment of the book, birds once again begin to sing. This cheerfulness is, in spite of everything, Vonnegut's characteristic note. It may be, as I've suggested, a cheerfulness beneath which much pain is hidden, but it is cheerfulness nonetheless. Vonnegut's prose, even when dealing with the dreadful, whistles a happy tune. 50 years after its first publication, 74 years after Kurt Vonnegut was inside Slaughterhouse-Five during the firebombing of Dresden, what does his great novel have to say to us? It doesn't tell us how to stop wars. It tells us that wars are hell. But we already knew that. It tells us that most human beings are not so bad, except for the ones who are, and that's valuable information. It tells us that human nature is the one great constant of life on earth, and it beautifully and truthfully shows us human nature, neither as its best nor at its worst, but how it mostly is, most of the time, even when the times are terrible. It doesn't tell us how to get to the planet Trafalmador, but it does tell us how to communicate with its inhabitants. All we have to do is build something big, like the pyramids or the Great Wall of China. Maybe the wall that some individual whom I will not name is planning to build between the United States and Mexico will be read as an urgent message on Trafalmador. The person who wants to build the wall will not know what the message means, of course. He is a pawn, being manipulated by a power greater than his to send the message in this time of great emergency. I hope the message reads, "Help." And now from the page-turner section of the December 3rd, 2015 edition of the New Yorker magazine, "How Jane Vonnegut Made Kurt Vonnegut a Writer" by Ginger Strand. Kurt Vonnegut, at age 22, didn't know what to do with himself. It was autumn, 1945. He was back from Europe, having survived the firebombing of Dresden as a prisoner of war, and he had convinced the love of his life, Jane Cox, to marry him. Beyond that, he had no positive ideas, only negatives. He wasn't going to be a scientist. His bad grades at Cornell made that clear. He didn't much like working in an office. At one point, he had considered law school, but not for long. And he knew for sure he wasn't going to be a writer. He wasn't good enough. He was still in the Army after his wedding on September 1, 1945. He had been assigned to Fort Riley, Kansas, where he was working as a clerk typist while awaiting his endlessly delayed discharge. It gave him plenty of time to ponder his future. Rich man, poor man, beggar man, thief, doctor, lawyer, merchant, chief, he wrote to his new wife that October. He wrote to her often, and the twin themes of these letters are his uncertainty about his future career and his love for her. Copies of the first 11 letters are at Indiana University's Lilly Library, but there are scores more still in the Vonnegut family's private possession. Jane Vonnegut was the family archivist, and while Kurt's letters have been preserved, hers have not. But even hearing just Kurt's side of the conversation gives a sense of how it went. Jane knew what her husband should do with his life, he should write. And she seems to have made it her first mission as his spouse to convince him of that. It would be easy to view these letters as sorry proof of yet another woman shunted to history's backstage. But their passionate and thoughtful character instructs us rather to re-see what we may have missed, to write Jane back into the story and acknowledge the clear-eyed ways in which she helped shape the Vonnegut narrative, both in life and on the page. Many of the ideas and themes that characterize Vonnegut
were born in the conversation between Kurt and Jane, and throughout his career, she remained a voice in the text. She was there. That was her. Jane and Kurt had known each other since kindergarten, long enough that Kurt could tell Jane she was his best friend, a less cliché declaration, perhaps, in 1943. He had confided in her for years, since they each left Indianapolis for college, he at Cornell, she at Swarthmore. His college letters laid out plans for house parties and weekend dates, bragged about his columns for the Cornell Sun, and occasionally made rosy predictions about his future as a biochemist. But his main subject was their mutual future. They would be married in 1945, he declared, as a sophomore. He placed a bet on it with a fraternity brother. They would have a home with books and art and a well-stocked bar. They would have friends over for intellectual conversations. They would have seven kids. He traced sevens behind his paragraphs and signed most of his letters with seven X's. They both dreamed of writing. Together, they fantasized about going to Europe or Mexico to work as news correspondents, going to Hollywood to work as screenwriters, building side-by-side studios in their backyard and pounding out masterpieces. "I wish I could write as well as you," he told her in an undated post-war letter. "Right now, you're the composer and I'm the musical instrument. We periodically swap roles." Vonnegut's letters are delightful, full of love and passion and thought, sprinkled with creative typography and illustrations. He drew yin-yang symbols, representing how they were two halves of a single whole. Like Howard Campbell and his wife Helga in Mother Night, Kurt and Jane were a nation of two. "The world is divided into two groups, us and the other people," he told her. "We'll win against any combination of powers." Once married, the pair began figuring out how to run that nation, which was to be, they decided, a nation of love, arts, common decency, and peace. Jane drafted a household constitution. "We cannot and will not live in and be hogtied by a society which not only has not faith in the things we have faith in, but which reviles and damns that faith with practically every breath it draws." Kurt was more pragmatic, casting about for career ideas, teaching, reporting, opening a library with a bar. Jane had just one idea, and she pressed it with patient determination. Kurt would be a writer, a great one. Her conviction terrified him. "You scare me when you say that I'm going to create the literature of 1945 onwards and upwards," he wrote to her in August of that year. "Angel, will you stick by me if it goes backwards and downwards?" Jane brooked no such doubts. She suggested books for him to read, The Brothers Karamazovs, War and Peace, and they discussed them by letter. She urged him to use his free time at Fort Riley to pound out stories. He worked from 5:30 to 7:30 each night and mailed his efforts back to Indianapolis for Jane to edit and retype. "Any changes you see fit to make, please make," he wrote of his fourth story in October. "This is not a work of art, but a grasping at money." He saw his writing as supplemental to whatever he might end up doing. He would need a steady income to support seven kids. Besides, he might not have the talent. When Jane found an Authors Council to send some of his stories to for comment, Kurt worried that he might not think the stories are so goddamned hot. "Angel, please go over the crap I've written for spelling and punctuation," he wrote. "I can picture you reading along and suddenly looking pained, running to get a pencil to hide from the world the astonishing gaps in the education of your loving husband." Her faith sometimes baffled him. "I can only hope, and this on your instigation, that I've not reached my full stature," he wrote. "I'm willing to work like a dog to attain it." And he did. But even as he slowly embraced her ambitions for himself, he remained determined to find another career, either a newspaper or an advertising firm, he told her. He could write in his free time. "I get sick with fear that I'm a bluff, that I'm actually no damned good," he confessed. "I don't want to let you and your fantastic hopes down with a thump. I don't want those fantastic hopes to take the place of love. I don't want successes to become the consummation of that love, because failures will be the death of it. But in November 1945, he wrote Jane in a fever of excitement. He had been reading the Foreign Affairs section of Newsweek when he realized something. Everything that was reported by ace newsmen from the heart of Europe, I found to be old stuff to me. By Jesus, I was there. That was me. I was there. That astonishing moment in Slaughterhouse 5 was the impetus for the entire book, first felt in 1945. His war experience was crying out to be written. He told her he was trying to remember every little thing that happened to him. He would write about that. But one thing was clear. I'll not be able to do it without your help. Next week, in a calmer mood, he articulated his new conviction. Rich man, poor man, beggar man, thief, doctor, lawyer, merchant, chief, he wrote, reprising his old theme. From your loving me, I've drawn a measure of courage that would never have come to me otherwise. You've given me the courage to decide to be a writer. That much of my life has been decided. Regardless of my epithet, to be a writer will have been my personal ultimate goal. Jane would continue to be the source of his confidence for the next 25 years. Many of the ideas and images for which he became known had their source in the couple's mutual dialogue. "You ask me questions I like to answer," he told her. In his letters to Jane, he mused on the nature of time, on the dangers of science, on the existence or non-existence of God. "The greatest man to ever live will be the one that invents the real God and presents the world with a book of his teachings," he wrote her in 1945. "A Bible written in a lunatic asylum may be the answer." It's hard to imagine a better summary of Bokanonism, the fictitious religion Vonnegut would go on to depict in Cat's Cradle. In Timequake, his semi-autobiographical last novel published in 1997, Vonnegut recalls that Jane submitted a controversial thesis when she was at Swarthmore. It argued that all that could be learned from history was that history itself was absolutely nonsensical. So study something else, like music. He is, in essence, glossing the last line of Slaughterhouse 5, where Billy Pilgrim wakes up to discover that the war has ended. He and his buddies wander outside into a springtime day. Birds are singing. One bird said to Billy Pilgrim, "Poutit, wheat?" As Jane had argued, there's no meaning to be made from a massacre, from death in industrial quantities. The only thing left to do is listen to the music of the birds. And as Father Zosima recommends in The Brothers Karamazovs, Jane's favorite novel and one of Kurt's, to ask forgiveness of them. As it turned out, Kurt's failures were not the death of their love, but his successes were. At least, that's what the chronology suggests. His departure in the middle of the 1960s for a teaching stint at the University of Iowa, where he completed Slaughterhouse 5, was the beginning of the end of their marriage. It didn't help that since 1958 they had faced the organizational and financial challenges of a household packed to bursting. Kurt's sister Alice and her husband, Jim Adams, had both died within a couple of days of each other, and Kurt and Jane adopted their four boys. Added to their own three children, that made the seven Kurt always said they would have. After Slaughterhouse 5 was published in 1969, Kurt never came home to Jane for good. His next novel, Breakfast of Champions, got a mixed reaction from critics. Buffeted by bad reviews and caught up in the protracted and painful dissolution of his marriage, he next wrote Slapstick, a novel about a brother and sister who are ignorant and fumbling when separated, but geniuses when they touch. In the autobiographical preface, he declared that his own sister Alice was the person he had always written for. "She was the secret of whatever artistic unity I had ever achieved. She was the secret of my technique." Lately, however, he could no longer feel her presence. Alice was surely on his mind, but he was also writing about Jane. "One peculiar feature of our relationship," he wrote Jane in 1943, "is that you are the one person in this world to whom I like to write. If I do write anything of length, good or bad, it will be written with you in mind." Slapstick follows what happens when siblings Wilbur and Eliza Swain are forcibly separated. Wilbur goes on to become president of the United States, while Eliza is locked away in an asylum. Coming into physical contact one last time, they write a manual on child-rearing. It goes as follows. We went berserk. I could no longer tell where I stopped and Eliza began, or where Eliza and I stopped and the universe began. It was gorgeous, and it was horrible. Yes, and let this be a measure of the quantity of energy involved. The orgy went on for 5 whole nights and days. Critics have largely taken Vonnegut at his word about slapstick, believing the book to be about Alice. But Jane was his compatriot in child-rearing. She was his other half, the yin of his yang, without whom he feared he might never get it right again. In a 1943 letter to Jane explaining why he loved her, he described their union as a kind of outburst, much like those of Wilbur and Eliza Swain. I have a number of wild dreams which come and go with the green and the leaves. Once conceived, I tell you about them. If they're good dreams, you take them up with a flood of enthusiasm, and we're very soon shrieking to each other about them in a transport of delight much greater than if the dream were realized. Then we sink back, logically, into each other's arms, happily exhausted by a swift trip to heaven and back. Read as a valedictory rumination on the end of marriage, on the loss that attends the collapse of any nation of two, Slapstick is a much better novel. In Timequake, Kurt recalls that Jane, by then Jane Vonnegut Yarmolinsky, phoned him near the end of her fight with cancer. She asked him to tell her what would determine the moment of her death. Why ask him? She may have felt like a character in a book by me, he muses. It seems like a heartless thing to say, especially when many critics, not to mention Vonnegut himself, have pointed out the paucity of fully realized female characters in his books. But in another way, he was simply being honest. Marriage merges individuals into a unit. Kurt and Jane Vonnegut worked together to build his career, a fact he readily acknowledged upon their separation. Jane has a strong feeling that we have both earned whatever we have, and she is right, he wrote his agent Donald Farber in 1973. Jane Vonnegut was, in some sense, a character invented by Kurt, but only in the sense that Kurt Vonnegut was, and equally, a character invented by Jane. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.